Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Speaking of consciousness, which will be one thread of our topic today, it's, of course, always an interesting challenge to try to grapple with the science of these matters, the material dimension of these matters, because if we're not a scientist, then we're always getting filtered stories through this complex morass of technical reports and translations into popular science language and all the issues that come with that. But if we are scientists, at least most of the time, we tend to be pretty narrowly focused on often very, very minute slices of the problem. And so unless we have the ability to communicate and consume and process much larger fields of information, then that doesn't necessarily help particularly either. I remember speaking with a neuroscientist near where I live in San Francisco, and he had written a book about some connections between his research and Tibetan Buddhism. And it was a pretty careful book, a small publication. But I was curious what his colleagues thought, and I was like, "Do they think that's a little weird? Do they like it? Are they inspired?" And he was like, "Are you kidding? They don't have time to read that. They have a stack 2 feet high of reports on one particular 5-HTP receptor on their desks that they're expected to somehow have gone through." And it really gave me a sense of how just enormous the amount of information there is about even very, very narrow slices of one particular scientific discipline. And then there's those of us on the outside trying to get some clue about something as significant as the relationship between ourselves, our consciousness, our perception of the world, and this, 3-pound squishy sponge that we have blocks inside our skulls, and so it's a tough one, and yet this is the condition we find ourselves in. I was reading a book by the German philosopher Sloterdijk the other day, a really great book called "You Must Change Your Life" about religion and practice in the modern world. Very interesting book, and he has a line about it in there about how human beings are sort of condemned to face tasks that they're not prepared for and yet have no choice but to take on, and trying to grapple with the nature of the mind and the nature of the brain and with the barrage of scientific facts and popular scientific accounts is one of those situations that we find ourselves in. So today we're going to inch our way up that impossible mountain with a discussion with Paul King. Paul King's an old friend of mine. He's a software entrepreneur and computer scientist that found his way through a kind of roundabout set of interests and research projects into neuroscience, and particularly computational neuroscience. So he's become more of a quote-unquote real neuroscientist, and he'll be talking about his journey and some of the many fascinating issues it raises. Just a moment, but first, of course, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dao. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How's your consciousness today?
My consciousness is good. You know, it's funny what you said about just the data volume, and I think about that, like, we, as our meat suit, just like strictly our meat suit walking around, you produce so much data that it would take lifetimes of people looking at what your meat suit produces to even come close to knowing what that data means. So it is. It's like this Sisyphean, if that's a word, thing. Like, I think about the Human Genome Project, like, just as an example. Like, that's all the DNA that we have in our bodies all the time. And yet it takes people, like, lifetimes to be able to just analyze that data to try to, like, make some kind of discernible, logical conclusion about it. You know, kind of an amazing predicament that we're in as human beings.
Yeah, so I mean, what you're saying is that the information overload is not just the fault of our pesky, you know, data-hungry machines, but it's part, it's sort of woven into the nature of the game from the get-go.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
totally
a very good way of putting it. Well, let's bring on Paul King to Expanding Mind. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So, you know, I thought it would be a good place to start out is to talk a little bit about how you went from being a software guy, a computer scientist working in the, you know, in the entrepreneurial world into the more rarefied world of science and neuroscience and how you got from A to B.
Sure. Well, I didn't follow the normal path. The normal path is you go to graduate school, often right out of college, and then you do a postdoc and you work your way up to research. In my case, I started out as a software engineer and later a software entrepreneur, but this interest in how the mind works and how the brain produces the mind, I was never quite able to shake that interest, and several years ago, Jeff Hawkins, the founder of Palm Computing, wrote a book called On Intelligence, and he started a neuroscience institute that later joined with Berkeley. And maybe 7 years ago, I got connected with that research institute and started going to neuroscience conferences and decided I wanted to become a scientist. But I sort of like to say that I infiltrated science. I networked in, went to conferences, read the textbooks, and pretty soon I was set up at Berkeley with connected with the lab and an office and a visiting scholar affiliation and doing neuroscience research.
Well, one of the things that, I mean, I remember, you know, talking to you at various points during that process, one of the things that I thought was so interesting about your avenue in is that because you didn't come up through, you know, graduate studies and doing it that way, you kind of came in at first almost like trying to get a sense of where, like, the whole field was. You were just kind of absorbing the information and getting a sense of how this sort of new world worked, and then gradually kind of found your way into that. And I would just love to hear you reflect a little bit about, you know, rather than going directly to the big issues, relationship of brain to consciousness, we'll get to that in a second, is to just, you know, give me some of your reflections on what that process was like, of like, what did you find out about how neuroscience work, how the sciences work, how how it was to kind of make your way or find your thread through this very complicated and sometimes controversial field.
Sure. Well, there are two things that really stood out for me in that process. The first was understanding how science works. I came from the world of technology, and in technology, the currency that matters is what kinds of problems you can solve. And in science, that's not what the focus is. In science, your reputation is built on not being wrong. And if you can first not be wrong and actually be right about some things, that's even better. So when you talk with scientists and ask them about their opinion on things, it's very difficult to get an answer. People won't express opinions. They'll cite facts. They'll say they don't know. They'll say it might work this way or maybe, or there's implications. So you have to get used to this very hedged way of speaking. That's one thing I noticed about science. Something I noticed about neuroscience in particular is that there, to my surprise, is an immense amount of information about the brain out there. Thousands, tens of thousands of facts, all produced by independent research studies about this and that. But the information, it's minutia. There's so much detail, and yet there's no big picture. There's no agreement on how the brain works. There's some speculative theories. The theories sort of fit together, sort of, but there's no central view of the brain like there is, let's say, when DNA was discovered and we now had this unified view of how cells work and biology works.
Can you, like, boil down sort of what the big conflicts are or the big issues that prevent a sort of more generally accepted model for the large scale system of the brain?
Well, I'd say maybe there's different ways of approaching that question. One is the brain is very complex. There are probably many layers to how it operates, and it's difficult to get at the living brain. The best information comes from recording on particular neurons, you know, connecting probes to neurons, and you can't do that in humans. And humans have the brains that we really care about. We want to know how the mind works, and what scientists have to do is infer the mind by studying rats running mazes, and that's really a long step to go from rats and mazes to human beings. So lack of information about the global functioning is one hurdle. The human brain is composed of 100 billion neurons, and the mind is produced by all those neurons working in concert, but scientists can only access 10 or 20 neurons at a time when they're doing experiments. So you're always looking at a very tiny sliver of the big picture. It'd be like trying to understand the U.S. economy by following 10 people around.
Well, but wouldn't that like kind of work? Like if there, like if you look at, you know, like holographically, technically, if they're all connected, theoretically, you would think what happens to neuron would be a larger image of what happens to the entire brain, or would that just not be true at all?
No, that's right, and that's what people try to do. They try to triangulate between these little glimpses of information and try to infer what's going on globally, but. You know, if you look at 10 neurons in this animal and 10 different neurons in this other animal at different points of time doing different tasks and somehow have to infer what that would happen in a whole brain, there's a lot of leaps of logic you have to take.
Right. Do they check out or they just don't check out? Like, have these theories just let people think, well, this should be true, and then it just doesn't end up happening?
Usually what happens is the theories are fairly vague, so the theories generally don't turn out to not be true. They just turn out to be incomplete.
I see.
And if I remember correctly, the particular issue that you were interested in is this question of artificial intelligence, you know, which is something that's discussed within computer science and people who are not necessarily working with the brain. They're thinking about how do we make a machine be intelligent, which of course raises this question, which is at once philosophical and scientific, which is what is intelligence? And I'm just kind of curious for you, coming from a computational background, a programming background, how your whole sense of the question of intelligence drove you, as it were, into the meat from the machine.
Sure. Well, I got probably my interest in AI and cognitive science came from reading Go to Lescherbach by Douglas Hofstadter, a book that inspired a lot of people. And I think... you know, when I was in college, I wanted to understand how to make computers intelligent. Artificial intelligence seemed like a path down that direction. And in looking into AI, I became disillusioned. I realized that computer scientists don't know how to create intelligence in a machine. And, you know, people try different things, and, you know, the best chess-playing computer still hasn't convinced anyone that there's a mind in there. And so it seemed that if we really want to understand how intelligence emerges from a mechanistic system, the best way to get there was to study the only known mechanism, the only mechanism system we know about, which is the brain. And so reverse engineering the brain seemed like the surest path to finding out how one creates a mind out of component parts.
Well, and that, but that's not, you know, a universal opinion. In fact, there seems to be, even though the classic hubristic dreams of artificial intelligence did not come to be, it still seems like we're at a place where there are lots of, you know, computer scientists and you know, programming, you know, extropian singularitarians who are just utterly convinced that the machines themselves are becoming intelligent, will become intelligent, just around the corner. What do you think is going on there? And what for you was the sign that, hey, this is not, we're barking up the wrong tree. We need to look at the brain.
Well, computers are certainly getting smarter in the sense that they can do more and more sophisticated things, but do computers have a mind? That seems to be a big part that's missing. Do computers have subjective perception? It doesn't seem like they do. I think folks in the singularity community, you know, Ray Kurzweil would like to draw an exponential graph and show that computers get more sophisticated, and if you extrapolate that out, well, pretty soon they'll be smarter than humans. But where does mind and subjective perception come in there? I think that's a qualitative effect that there really aren't any ideas for right now.
Well, let's dive into that stuff. I mean, as you're, and you can talk about even how your own understanding of things changed, or how the models or metaphors you use to talk about it with other people have changed. But how are you feeling about this fundamental question of the relationship between consciousness as a quality, as a set of experiences, as that phenomenological texture to it, that sense of immediacy, the relationship between that flow of consciousness, or if it even is a flow, and the physical brain? I mean, have you gone through sort of major changes in how you see that relationship, or are you still running on some of the core intuitions or ideas that drew you into it?
Well, I would guess I would say that my general belief that the mind is generated by the brain has not changed. And that's the view in neuroscience as well. Neuroscientists believe that neurons acting in concert create the mind, and if you were to get rid of the neurons, the mind goes away as well. Certainly, the ability of general anesthesia to extinguish consciousness seems consistent with that. So I would say that hasn't changed. One thing that did become apparent as I started to get involved in the field is that the way people think about the brain, the way scientists think about it, has become more and more statistical. It appears that the neural networks of the brain are a statistical computer of sorts, different from a digital computer, but they're operating on probabilistic models of the world, and the brain is trying to make some guess about what's out there as we interact with the environment. And a parallel path that's happening is in computer science. There's a field called statistical machine learning. This is the computer science behind the algorithms that Google uses, for example, to show you relevant ranked results, or that Amazon uses to make product recommendations. And these algorithms are using the same methods. They're making statistical models of the world based on the information they have in order to make predictions about the future. And it appears that the brain does the same thing. It just does it using slightly different algorithms than what computers use.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up, because I've been really interested in this connection to the extent that I've been able to read about it and think about it. But one of the questions I have is, how did that happen historically in terms of neuroscience, in the following sense? Was it not until people started to explore machine learning in a probabilistic universe where you're basically making statistical guesses, you're dealing with the world as a set of unknowns that has probabilistic characteristics that then the algorithms sort of probe, was that kind of computing developed inside computer science to work with some of these other problems with Amazon and Google and other things, and then people kind of go, hey, this might be what's happening in the brain? Or was it sort of concurrent ideas? And it seems so weirdly, appropriate now that's part of the way the computing is going, at least with certain kinds of problems. And it's like, hey, this looks like it's what the brain's doing. It's kind of a remarkable parallel.
You're asking which came first, the biology or the computer science?
In a way, yeah.
So I think they happen in parallel, to be honest. On the biology side, statistics has a long history of being used in all aspects of science, and especially in biology. In biology, you can never get sort of a sure thing, so you have to do lots of experiments and statistically model what's happening in those experiments. So the statistics was well developed to serve science. And then I think in parallel, statistics started being used more in computer science because people wanted to do large-scale data analysis, not only in science but of consumer data. And perhaps one conference that brought these two things together was a conference called Neural Information Processing Systems that was founded by a neuroscientist, Terry Cisnowski, And this conference started maybe 25 years ago, bringing together neural network ideas that emerged in the late 80s with a book called Parallel Distributed Processing and introduced the idea of neural networks. And this conference initially was focused on neural networks, bringing together biologists and mathematicians mostly to try to understand these abstract statistical models. And, you know, in some ways an offshoot of the cybernetics movement, let's say, of the 1960s. And what happened is that the computer scientists started getting so much traction that the biologists got pushed out. And so this conference continues, the Neural Information Processing Conference, but there's no more biology or neural anything in it anymore. It's all computer science.
Let me ask, just out of curiosity, if you attended any of those when the biologists were there, because this is something I wonder about, too, if any of the computer scientists and neuroscientists would look at things like without brains that would do similar neural networking things, like, you know, fungus under dirt or things that don't have neurons that could exhibit that kind of behavior, right?
Yeah, so I think there's
that ever come up?
Yeah, I think there's a world called systems theory, chaos theory, complex systems science. And they do think about this sort of thing, like, you know, organisms like, you know, fungus or plants and other kinds of abstract dynamical systems. The folks at this NIPS conference, the Neural Information Processing Systems, they're pretty, you know, hardcore data analysis, and I think they would consider, you know, plants sort of a little bit outside of their thought world.
Right.
So is the basic idea that what the brain is, because the brain, you know, in terms of its trying to deal with the environment is unpredictable, and so the best way, just from a strict neo-Darwinian perspective, the best way, if you have a, you know, an intelligent brain trying to deal with the environment over time, it makes sense that the way that it would deal with and the unknowns in the environment is to explore these different ways of essentially employing math to come up with good guesses for how to deal with things.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. If you think about the brain's predicament, all it has is a bunch of signals coming in on neurons from the senses, and out of that, it has to figure out what's out there. You know, are there houses and trees? People, that all has to be discovered based on these abstract signals coming in. So the brain is sort of in the same situation as a scientific lab might be, or let's say a war room that's trying to make sense of what's going on the battlefield in some central headquarters based on conflicting reports coming in from the field. And based on that, it has to make some guesses and try out some hypotheses, and if the brain sort of interacts with the world and it doesn't go the way it expects, it has to update its models and come up with a new framework for what's out there based on, you know, new reports coming in.
Can you explain what the relationship is with this statistical thing that we're talking about and a phrase I've heard, neuroeconomics? Is there some relationship with this? Or, I mean, my impression was that people are trying to, that, you know, since some economics use these mathematical models and trying to gauge probability and make good guesses and things like that, whether that's partly referring to that, or is it, have you heard of, have you come across this?
Sure. No, I have a friend who's a leader in the field of neuroeconomics. It seems that you can put neuro in the front of any field name and suddenly turn it into a trendy field.
There we go.
Well, I have another question for you, which is something I always think about, too. So a lot of the data that, you know, these folks and probably you two are examining are reactionary, correct? So, like, how the brain reacts to the environment, right?
I think so. I think that's right. I mean, that's probably the only thing you can really observe about the brain.
Well, because my question was if there's been any work or how you feel, how would you measure, like, say, a priori knowledge, which doesn't seem to be fed into the brain, but that arise, like instincts, right? So how would they account, like if the brain is just this constant thing that's reacting to stimulus from its environment, then what about things that, like, it hasn't figured out as a result of something, or, like, something that innately just a reaction that comes from seemingly, like, no kind of discernible place? I mean, I guess I don't know how they would test that, but is there any work, like, towards that, or they just don't even think about that or consider it?
So you're talking about the things that we seem to be sort of born knowing or able to do, that kind of thing?
Exactly.
So the way this this sort of abstract field of learning theory views it is it says, you know, evolution is optimizing for survival, and the brain is also optimizing for survival. Its job is to learn enough about the environment that it can get us through life and onto reproduction. And, you know, before the brain, or for, you know, earlier in evolution organisms, everything that the organism needed to survive had to somehow be encoded in the DNA, because that's sort of all there was. So you could think of the DNA as, among other things, representing encoding this wiring diagram that was going to get the organism, you know, through life successfully. But there's only so much room in DNA for a model of what you need to do to survive. And also, the world is always changing. The DNA can't predict, you know, what kind of environment you're going to find yourself in, or if the weather is going to change, or you know, moist areas are going to become a desert area over, you know, some thousands of years. So the survival strategy that evolution converged on was one of building an organ that had some things pre-wired and some things learned. And,
okay, so this is where I'm going with that question then, because if it's true that the mind is only in the neurons, which exist from this kind of like interplay, then if it uses DNA as like a storage system, then wouldn't you think like that would mean the mind is kind of partially in other parts as well? Or is that not true at all, that the DNA is just more of like an external hard drive that's not included or something? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I would say neuroscientists would say that the DNA is sort of a read-only storage, so you can't really write to the DNA.
So it has no participation with the mind. It's like a thing the mind just kind of sends a tentacle out to, like, scoop stuff from, and then it goes back to its own little thing.
Well, the DNA maybe sets the framework that the mind's going to fill into. So the DNA maybe creates the skeleton of the mind, and then experience builds in that skeleton.
Oh, okay, okay. So it's more like, it is, it's more like a closet. Dip into, right?
Well, and, you know, DNA is a, evolution is a slowly learning process. You know, you have to wait for mutations and many generations for DNA to change, so it changes very slowly. And it changes mostly by trial and error, whereas the brain can change by getting information and then updating its networks and rewiring itself. You know, the neuroplasticity that everyone talks about.
So if what part of what you're looking at with the computational statistical side is something that's, you know, a really important model for how intelligence is working, how decisions are being made, how things are being constructed, and at the same time we have, you know, more and more robust computer algorithms that are exploring these things, and some of the same algorithmic situations are being exploited in both fields. Does that make you more positive or hopeful, or how does that impact your sense of whether or not we'll be able to make more or actually intelligent machines? Since it seems to share.
I'd say I have a paradoxical view there. I'm more hopeful that it's going to be possible, and I think it's going to take much longer than I would have thought.
Because the computational difficulties are so much, or because we still know so little about the brain, or what's the length?
I think it's because, well, there's still a lot we don't know about the brain. But what we do know about the brain is it works in a very complex way. It's a very decentralized dynamic system that has emergent phenomenon, and those emergent phenomena interact with each other. And it's a type of system that we don't really know how to study. It's not very easy to control. It's not very easy to turn into a set of rules and mechanisms. So it seems as though our understanding of how to even grapple with that kind of system and understand it is still very much at early stages. So in the machine world, we may have better luck with building programs in the way that we have more familiarity with, because we know how those kinds of programs work and we can control them better, but we still don't know how to create a mind with that. So that path might be productive, but it might not get us
to go. It seems so weird to me that they're discluding the biologists for that, because it's like, okay, you guys are trying to figure out that the leap it takes for the machine to go from, you know, data to intelligence or consciousness. But what about in nature, like things that right don't have those like neurons or mind, but yet they seem to, like a protein strand that goes from a protein strand to a virus that can then exhibit like weird conscious behavior. Like, do you feel like theoretically, if that can happen to like some strand of protein, and then it can all of a sudden like develop this kind of like behavior that would seem to think it's, you know, has perception abilities and is reacting to things and stuff like that. Do you feel like that would be the same or different than the leap with, you know, what we're developing with the technology?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's always a little bit risky to anthropomorphize molecules.
Right.
Certainly, they seem like they can, you know, kind of change, and they're trying to find a strategy, you know, to sort of survive in the world. But often it's just by being buffeted around by collisions with other molecules.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of random.
I mean, that's how scientists would look at it. They would say, oh, it's just a bunch of random processes that, you know, over time produce something that looks meaningful.
Well, I want to ask you more about the sort of emergent properties of the large-scale system of the brain, but we got to take a break here first. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Paul King about the brain, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're having a little chat with Eric Davis and Paul King about the mystery of the human mind. And before the break, Eric had mentioned maybe a little bit more about the emergent kind of aspect of this stuff. And I was curious if, like, for you personally, since you've started, like, researching this, up until this point, have you seen like that kind of, you know, I know you mentioned like how the singularity folks say, well, it's progressing like this, so logically it just means we'll get there. But have you, like, over your career seen it emerge in a way where you were like, oh my God, maybe this will really happen? Or do you feel like what kind of like is your opinion on what you've witnessed from it so far?
Well, I guess when I first started getting connected in with neuroscience, I was surprised just how much information was known about the brain, and that made me very hopeful that we were going to figure it out, and I do think we will figure it out. I don't know if that's answering your question.
Yeah, so you would say it does look like we're going to head that direction.
Yeah, I think eventually we will figure it out. I think it's going to... you know, the brain works very differently from the types of systems we're used to. It works very differently from a digital computer. And maybe one of the things that's most unique about it is that there's no central controller. In a computer, there's a central processing unit, and everything goes through that, and everything's controlled and sequenced. And the brain works much more like, you know, perhaps the Internet. You have all these different independent components out there that are all doing their own thing and sending signals to each other and exchanging information. You know, maybe it's, you could think about it like civilization. Everyone is doing their own thing in the world, and yet you get this meaningful, coherent behavior that we call civilization and culture and these, you know, complex
things. Well, that is biologically interesting, because I think about, like, the heart, right? Like, the heart beats in unison because there's biologically this thing called the sinus node, and then all the cells have the striations which cause them to go together. But so in the brain, there is no, like, sinus node pump that's keeping them all to the rhythm. You're saying they all just kind of, like, dance like crazy and somehow end up in the right spot?
Yeah, I think of the rhythms in the brain as being, like, like a drum circle. You know, drum circles where people gather on the fire and they no one necessarily leads it, but people align and join and leave each other's rhythm. So imagine something like that, but with 100 billion drummers who can't all hear each other, but they can hear the 10,000 drummers that are nearest to them. Through that process, the networks are passing information around. But each neuron in this network is, doing its own thing based on what it hears from its neighbors.
So how, in that process of trying to grapple with this large-scale systematic behavior of the brain, and that was one thing we talked about before the the interview, you were saying that was one kind of shift that we're seeing. That we're in the midst of is that earlier brain science was very focused on what was happening on a micro scale, what's happening on the level of the neuron, what neurotransmitters are working where, and how we can articulate the sort of specific events very deep in the brain. And now it's more and more clear that we're not going to answer these big questions until we start dealing with the brain as a whole system. And you've talked a little bit about how it's not the kind of system that we're used to. It's not a computer. It's very decentralized. So given that, and given that we're not talking about specific neurotransmitters on that kind of level, what are the tools that people are using to understand or model or grapple with this large-scale system behavior of the brain?
Yeah, well, what you point out sort of leads, I think, to an interesting trend in the field, which is 30 years ago, there was a field emerging called cognitive science, which was trying to understand how the mind worked by observing people, having them push buttons and do tests and see how long it took to do a certain task or how many words people could memorize. This famous idea of 7 ± 2 things you could hold in memory came out of those types of studies. And cognitive science is really looking at the mind from the outside, what you could measure. And then in parallel at that same time, neuroscience, the field of neuroscience, was emerging, which was looking, first at neuroanatomy, just what the brain is shaped like, and then later at how the individual neurons work, inside the neuron, and really it may be the neurotransmitters and receptors, but just the individual neuron. So these two fields were very far apart and had no communication. But as neurons got figured out, neuroscientists started looking at how sections of the brain interact, and in parallel, cognitive science started learning more about neuroscience, and then fMRI emerged, these colorful pictures you see of like a brain scan with certain parts of the brain, quote, lighting up. And those, that particular visualization and technique connected those two fields together. Suddenly, cognitive science got new legitimacy because it could say, oh, we're neuroscientists because we're looking at what's going on inside the brain using brain scans. And suddenly these two fields could actually talk about some of the same things. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask you a little bit more about cognitive science. This may sound like a kind of a Rube question, but, in the fields that I'm familiar with that are more in the humanities, there's increasingly these kind of cognitive science moves into the humanities to try to say, hey, we can actually talk about some of these literary questions in terms of the brain and da-da-da. And there's a lot of, it's an interesting kind of jostling of disciplines. And so the kind of cognitive science that people are engaging with and the kind of cognitive scientists who are engaged in this conversation are not necessarily the guys who are paying super close attention to the neurology of everything, and they're coming more from a philosophical or psychological kind of perspective. But I'm often kind of puzzled because it seems like a lot of what they do is sort of come up with models using language of, temporal fields or, schemas. And so they create this kind of language to try to explain the kind of logical elements behind the way that we think on the surface. But it doesn't really necessarily seem to lock into any particular model of how the brain itself actually works. So I'm a little puzzled and sometimes kind of skeptical about some of the of cognitive science in terms of where exactly it's kind of sitting. And maybe I'm just kind of processing the whole thing wrong, but I'm kind of curious how you see the role of cognitive science
you know, outside of you know, the specific neuroscientific work that you're interested in, which is more straight science, what exactly is the role of cognitive science? To come up with models, to come up with maps of higher order emergent properties? How do we deal with that? These are my queries.
Yeah. I mean, it might be that the role of cognitive science is evolving, and maybe it's even being overtaken by neuroscience or subsumed by it. You know, it seemed 20 years ago what cognitive science scientists like to do is come up with these proposed models of how the mind works, and the models often look like boxes with arrows pointing between them about information comes into some language center and then is sent to some associative learning center. Or, you know, the models had different parts. And they're all fictions. They're all made up. None of them correspond to brain areas exactly. And they were just these kind of diagrams to try to explain what people were seeing. But the way the brain actually works isn't anything like that. The brain doesn't have modules that send information to other modules. The brain's all connected, and it's all communicating constantly. So I think a lot of those old cognitive science models have been somewhat abandoned because the brain doesn't actually work that way.
I wonder if there's some, if that came from like phrenology or so, like, is that straight up phrenology like coming in, or what? How did that happen? Like,
I have heard. So again, you know, these fMRI pictures that show parts of the brain lighting up. I have heard that compared somewhat derisively to phrenology. You know, what does it really mean for a certain part of the brain to light up when people do certain things? One thing I can say about those images is they're very misleading. You look at these images where the whole brain scan is black except for like one part of the brain that's like bright orange, and you get the impression that the whole brain is silent except for that one piece. And that's not at all what's going on. The brain is almost active. The brain is fully active at a almost constant level all the time. And to make these pictures, what they do is they'll have the person do the same task 20 times, and then they'll average the results of all the brain scans, and then threshold like the difference between 99% active and 100% active, and throw away everything that's 99% and below, and only show you the 100% as an analogy.
All
right. So when they show the rest of the brain being dark, it's actually almost just as active as the lit up place. Well, it just doesn't make their point quite as well.
But this is a great. I'm really glad you said that, because one of the things that's happening that you alluded to at the beginning was just that, you know, we're sitting here interested in this, non-scientists trying to take in information. And, you know, some of the way this stuff is presented, even earnestly, without attempts at trickery or trying to put together some agenda, are problematic. And that don't recognize the complexity, that don't recognize the different ways of looking at these issues. There's this overwhelming tendency. People want to know the answer. They want to have a model. They want to say, this is what it means to think. This is what it means to, you know, make decisions. And so I'm curious, for you, sitting there as you've, you know, really become a neuroscientist over these years, when you see the way that neuroscience gets represented in popular media and in people's thinking, how people are just trying to grapple with some of this information out on the street, so to speak. What are some of the things that really irk you or really disappoint you or that you really wish you could say, no, it doesn't work that way. Don't think about that. It's a myth.
Well, one thing I noticed about that is, first of all, it's great that information about neuroscience is getting out in the world. The brain's, I think, one of the last great frontiers where we don't have a clear scientific model, and there's a lot of curiosity about it, and it's great that people are learning about it. But there are certain neuroscience concepts that seem to become a bandwagon, let's say, in pop psychology, and they seem to take on a life of their own that has no longer much relationship to neuroscience. So I think one example of these are mirror neurons. Everyone seems to want to talk about mirror neurons these days.
Yeah, totally.
And the mirror neuron phenomenon that was actually found in the brain is fairly limited and specific, and that is that in monkeys, there are certain neurons that will be active when the monkey performs a certain task, and they're also active when the monkey observes someone else, like a human or another monkey, performing that same task. So that's what they found, and that's sort of all that they found. But if you listen to pop psychology, you think that mirror neurons are responsible for emotional empathy, social communication, our understanding of other people. Everything about social psychology is somehow tied in with mirror neurons, and that's, it's extrapolating quite a bit from what the science has actually found.
But that seems to be one of the things that happens, is that there's all of these mysteries that we face as human beings. Empathy, what is that? Is it something, can we cultivate it? Can it help? Can it solve political problems? Is it an illusion? You know, that's big. That's stuff you deal with every day. We deal with your friends and your enemies. You got to deal with empathy. But we don't know where to put it. Where does it come from? We used to say it came from God. We used to say it came from, you know, the structure of the soul. And now we're like, well, I can't say that anymore. But we have this science stuff. Hey, you know, laboratory experiment with monkeys showing, you know, some kind of small, pretty, you know, micro behavior. Oh, that must be it. And then we leap.
But
you know,
it's even
we put
deeper
these
than
big
that,
things.
Eric.
What's that?
It's even deeper because it's not just empathy. Because if you think about the implications, which these dum-dums are saying about the mirror neurons, yeah, they'll like see someone else doing it and then empathize. But what about if they see someone killing someone else? And then they'll like kill, you know, if a chimp sees another chimp kill someone, then it does the same thing, which is just the whole monkey see, monkey do thing, which we've known for a long time. But then it's not just empathy. It takes it to the place where somehow in our brains, they'll see and empathize, I guess, if that's the right word, with this behavior. But then, this is where it gets tricky, because there's the individual brain in its little drum circle, like you so well described, Paul, will be able to make its own decision. Oh, should I just kill this person like this other person did? Or what am I going to do? Right? So it's even beyond empathy. It's that, like, uber consciousness, right?
Well, so one subfield of neuroscience that seems to be emerging is the neuroscience of morality. You know, what is it, what's going on in the brain when people make these moral trade-offs? People are trying to do experiments around that and find certain brain areas that seem to be involved in, you know, self-interest versus altruism. It's hard to know what to make of those studies at these early stages, but it's interesting that people are connecting that kind of those kinds of things with particular brain areas.
Right.
So do you see that, like, how to navigate that kind of problem? Like, so I'm sitting here and I'm reading the newspaper and I'm reading New Scientist or something, and I'm seeing these social psychologists kind of build this elaborate construct, this kind of story based on some much more limited findings. And it's so, you know, it's seductive, it's easier in a way to kind of go with that. Can you counsel something, some way to begin to understand a little bit more when things are being elaborated far beyond what the research itself will support? Or are we just on our own here?
Well, I guess I'd say if it's a neat, clever story that suddenly makes it all make sense, it's probably wrong.
That's wonderful.
It seems like everything that we find out about the brain is complex and nuanced, and everything's interdependent on everything else, and it's hard to find sort of one simple story that ties it all together. But of course, everyone wants a simple story. So
here's a better scientific question, which may be what Eric was trying to get at. Have there been neuroscientific studies that have included maybe like chemical responses from emotional reactions to see, like, how do those influence the neuron? Like, is there an interaction between emotional chemicals and neurons?
Sure. Well, oxytocin is one of the neurochemicals that people like to talk about a lot these days in the context of emotion. This is the pair bonding chemical. It seems to be it's released when mothers bond with children. It seems to possibly relate to pairing. I mean, one can talk about romantic love in humans, but it's studied in prairie voles and how they pair. So there's an example of a neurochemical that seems to have an emotional role. it's hard to say whether the chemical is producing the emotion or the chemical is the emotion. But, yeah, there you go.
One more question. We have about less than 10 minutes now, and we spoke before, and you said something very intriguing, and I held back asking you more because I want to do it on the show. Is you were talking about how much the brain constructs perception, you know, our naive experiences that I'm looking at the bush. The bush is green and shiny and great, it's out there. There's a green and shiny thing out there. But that, speaking from a neuroscience perspective, the brain is constructing that perception based on very different kinds of signals, and so that what we're actually perceiving individually is in many ways a construction. But you said that it was a more of a top-down construction than a bottom-up construction, and I'm really curious if you can flesh out what you mean there.
Sure. So, at one level, I guess we know that what we see and what's out there are a little bit different. We see colors, but what they really are light frequencies, and we somehow get color from that. The light that hits the retina and that is processed by the first visual processing area in the brain, it's only looking at tiny little regions of the visual field, regions that are, let's say, smaller than your outstretched pinky. It's looking for things like edges and corners and little fragments. What we see is this visual field that seems to reach out in front of us and, completely fill everything, 180 degrees in each direction. And what neuroscience shows is that very little of that information is actually getting to the higher level areas of the brain. There's a lot of filtering that happens. When we see an object, the early parts of our brain, they don't have any access to information about objects. They're looking at tiny pieces. It's sort of like the story about the elephant where one person feels the trunk and someone else feels the tail. That's a lot of what's going on in the brain. So what happens is that these signals come in from the retina. They go through different brain areas, and essentially hypotheses are being constructed at the higher level brain areas about what might be out there. And those hypotheses are then fed backwards along that same chain of brain areas to see if the data coming in from the eyes fits that model. And this is often why optical illusions work. If you think about the child in the bedroom at night that sees, clothes piled up on a chair and thinks it's a monster, the monster that you see is something that's a construction of your, higher level brain areas that is not contradicted by the visual input, and so you see this object, but obviously what's out there is not that object.
So this is a wonderful place where we can see the kind of probability in action, and I know that this is also, this process is often used to evoke an element of religion or supernatural thinking. People are asking, why across the world in every culture are there gods and spirits and things that go bump in the night, and one of the explanations is that, it's in an evolutionary perspective, it's better for the brain to overread the possibility that rustling or that lump of clothes is actually some kind of agent, some kind of something that's alive, because you're more likely to be careful and not get into trouble when it's actually a tiger. So we have this tendency not only to probabilistically guess whether or not the pile of clothes is a creature, but that we tend to even overread that a little bit because it makes sense. But that's an interesting story. It's one worth talking about. You may have a comment about it, but what seemed interesting to me here is just connecting that with the discussion we had earlier about probability and statistics, where the brain is, it could be that. I have a map or a template for an agent in my head already, so let's just guess that it is an agent, and it's kind of doing this probing and this construction all the time. But do you mean top-down in the sense that we have these templates and schemas sort of already ready to go inside? Is that what you mean by that?
Neurosis is neurological.
Well, I mean, you make a good point about, is sometimes the brain sort of overreaching in terms of, drawing conclusions based on information that's too tenuous. And it's really a balancing act. I think one of the things the brain is always doing is it's trying to find the perfect spot along being either overreaching and overhypothesizing or underreaching. There are problems with going too far in either way. If the brain overreaches, you essentially get mania and hallucinations and psychosis because what you're seeing is very disconnected from the concrete world. But if you if the brain's too conservative, you miss obvious things. You know, things that are clear to everyone, you sort of don't see because you're being so literal about the world. So the brain has to sort of find some balance, and often it gets the balance wrong.
So we haven't been able to, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I just wanted to let you explain what your particular work is and where your research has taken you. And we won't be able to go into detail, but just to sort of, you know, show how these issues are you know, focused on a particular research question.
Yeah, well, you know, when I started getting interested in neuroscience, what I wanted to understand was how does the brain work? And in particular, how does the brain work if you think of the brain as a sort of biological computer of some sort? But one thing you find out pretty quickly in science is it's very difficult to tackle big questions. The questions have to get more and more narrow until you get something you can get traction on. So my interest in how the brain works became an interest in how the visual system works, because that's something a little bit more specific. And then in particular, how the early part of the visual system works, the part called V1. And then in particular, how the neural circuits in V1 are able to discover patterns in the world. And that's where my focus became, trying to understand how the neurons in their interconnected patterns were able to work together collaboratively, if you will, to discover patterns about the world and develop a representational scheme. You know, the brain isn't born knowing how to represent the world. It has to figure it out based on data. And that's what I did my particular research on.
Great. That's fascinating stuff. So were you actually doing what were the actual studies that you were looking at? Were you looking at other people's studies? Were you creating research protocols? Where was your data coming from?
Yeah, so I was building computer simulations. So what I wanted to find out is, could we develop a model that where computer-simulated neurons acted as closely as possible to the real neurons, what we know about real neurons, and could those simulated neurons, if presented with a series of images of, visual images from the world, could those neurons develop representational schemes, coding schemes? And what we found with my collaborators is that we could develop a neural circuit that had many of the same neural properties as the visual part of the brain, and these neurons developed a representational scheme that matches what's actually been found in the visual part of the brain. That is, the neurons learned to find edges that were at different orientations, and one of the first discoveries that was made about the brain's representation was that the visual part of the brain does the same thing. The early visual system actually detects edges, and the neurons respond to edges at different angles.
Yeah, I've read about that. It's really fascinating work, and in a way it comes around once again to an earlier theme that we had about the convergence of computational and biological models. But we're going to have to wrap it up there. Hey, Paul, thanks so much for being on the show and going through our goofy questions here, because it really helps to get the word out.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Great. All right, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.